Today is Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Muledy-Meekham, spelled Muleady-Meecham. My name is Tom Martin. This is part five, interview with Nancy. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I'm very well. Thank you.
Great. In the end of part four, you had taken us on this amazing journey to Africa and the top of Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
And then we ended, wrapped that up, and you were going to go back to be a naturalist at large in 1987. Can you pick that up for me, please?
I can. One of the things I did, and I think it's for 14 years, was I was a seasonal. And when you're a seasonal for the National Park Service, the most you ever work in any one park is usually 6 months at a time.
Okay.
And so every 6 months, I changed my life. And I had a camper van, and it had to be a van because I grew up driving a van. And also I had my grandmother's rocking chair from Ireland that my mom had given to me, and it had to be big enough to fit the rocking chair to take from place to place.
Oh, God.
So I, for a long time, I just looked forward to minimally living, having my beloved book collection in my parents' attic, and then moving. And so when I finished up a particular park, say it was at Sequoia, you know, that's when I, you know, went to Ireland and then worked as a paramedic and would maybe work at a winter park or whatever. So I got to pick and choose every 6 months what I thought I was going to do. But the pattern began to show itself very distinctly that my heart park, my home park that I love the most, was Sequoia.
Hmm.
So I always went back there in the summer, but in the winter times I had a lot more flexibility as to what I was going to do. So after Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi, I went back to be a park medic instructor for the next class of park medics at VMC, which is now UMC in Fresno. And so that was from January through February of 1987, excuse me. And then there was a two-month period in there that a man by the name of Rich Stoll, who I had known through the district naturalist Bill Tweed, had a program called Naturalists at Large.
Hmm.
And it was a kind of an outdoor ed thing, but what he did, rather than have the kids go to some outdoor ed camp, they went to Sequoia National Park in the wintertime.
Oh, wow.
And so because of his connection with people, he was able to get permits. And what they would do is they would take kids in middle school, pretty much, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, before high school.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go and we would learn about, you know, tracks in nature, adaptations to the cold. You know, if you're an animal, you either hibernated, you know, migrated, or you existed, you know, on what you could cache, for instance. So they learned all about that, and then they spent the night in tents.
Oh, wow.
And so one of the reasons that they asked me to come, this was fairly new. I can't remember how many seasons they had been there, but it was kind of, I was a naturalist at Sequoia, so I already knew the resource, but also could work, help out if there were any emergencies, being a paramedic and stuff. And I would camp with them and go from tent to tent to make sure everybody was okay. And it was usually pretty normal kids. There was every now and then you'd get somebody who was kind of exceptional, like Ray Kroc's granddaughter was there. And if you don't know Ray Kroc, he was the founder of McDonald's.
Hmm.
So she was there, and then every now and then you get some kid. I remember one winter I got called to one of the administrators' rooms, and they said, we have this kid in here, and he's climbing the walls. And I went inside, and he literally was climbing the wall up on the windowsill and stuff. And I said, well, this is not good. And his heart was just beating, you know, to beat the band, and he was just really hyper. And come to find out that he didn't want to miss anything, so he went and bought some Nodos and took them all.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is a lot of caffeine for a little kid.
You bet.
So we ended up taking him down to the emergency room. He ended up being fine. So occasional things like that,
yeah.
But nothing really untoward, no broken bones or anything. So during the daytime, we had a lot of fun, and they learned about stuff, and then they got to camp out nighttime. So I did naturalist at large for them that particular winter. And then when that was done.
Hey, Nancy.
Yeah?
Sorry, I'm going to jump in. Rick Stoll, is that S-T-O?
Rich Stoll, R-I-C-H-S-T-O-W-E-L-L.
Great, thank you.
Right, and I think I got the gig through Marianne Carlton, who had done Naturalist at Large for him a couple of times.
Ah. This is your friend Marianne that you went to Africa with?
Right, she went the first 3 weeks.
Got it, yeah.
And
yeah.
We worked different, and she was at Sequoia National Park.
And she was at Florida Everglades with you, and yeah.
Well, she was at Royal Palm, and I was down at Flamingo. But yeah, she was the one who went back, and
right.
She ended up being my maid of honor. So
we're still
really great friends today.
Cool.
And so when I finished being a natural history instructor for Naturalists at Large, I still had a couple of months before my working at Sequoia National Park, and so several things happened there. When I was teaching the park medic instructor course, one of the naturalists said, look, I've got somebody who's leaving, and I really could use you working at Death Valley.
Hmm.
And I said, well, and he said, just for, a couple of months.
Oh.
And he said, just from, just from March to May. And I said, well, I can do that, March to May. And because I could just step right on in. And knew how to give the programs, and they had housing all set for me, so they didn't have to train anybody.
Great.
So, but in between then, I still had too much, so then I worked as a paramedic, again, back in Modesto for mobile life support for a couple of months. Then went to let's see if I get this. Oh, I take it back. When did that happen? So, 1960. Out. I went back to Death Valley, but I also, can you pause it for a second? Or do we just talk?
Just talk it out. It's all right.
I'm looking at a timeline here that helps me out. And it says we're in the 87. So I did that at Death Valley, and it's not on the timeline. I actually did that back in 85.
Okay.
I think it was when I went back and worked as a naturalist. Stepped right on in.
Okay.
So when I went back to Death Valley for a couple of months, I actually went back as a protection ranger.
Oh.
It says here, but I'm not certain that that's correct. So I went back to Death Valley.
Okay.
And I already had my seasonal commission, so I might have done both. It might have been one of those where I did both of those, but I'd have to double check that. But it makes sense that I went back in protection. At Stovepipe Wells at that time, or Furnace Creek for a very short time. And then, beginning in May until October, I went back to Sequoia National Park as a seasonal interpreter. And I also began a dual job there, where I became the Emergency Medical Services Coordinator, the EMS Coordinator.
Okay.
So I worked, I think it was 70% time as a naturalist and 30% time for protection. And that was all kinds of behind-the-scenes stuff where the park medics needed to get their continuing education. I taught continuing education classes for the EMTs. I audited their run sheets. I coordinated with the resident liaison through the emergency room. Did a lot of the stuff that people don't show on TV because it's boring.
Right.
And
right.
As well as went on calls and things like that.
Hey, Nancy,
so,
we may have talked about this earlier. I was just thinking about the concept of incident command.
Right.
When did that come in here?
Oh, well, incident command has been around for decades. And
it been around for decades in 1987?
It started in the late 60s, early 70s, the concept of it, after the riot in Yosemite.
Okay.
And what happened is, again, back in those days, the friendly ranger didn't carry an obvious gun, didn't wear body armor. But the riot in Yosemite changed that. They realized that they really needed police powers amongst the people to take care of the evil people that were starting to come to national parks. And, you know, taking people's cars, driving drunk, having riots in Yosemite, all kinds of stuff. So they thought, well, we could send the park police, but we don't have enough park police, or we could take these rangers and start to specialize them. And mm-hmm. so that's when that happened. So the split began, I believe, in the late 60s.
Okay, so by 1987, that program had been around for quite a while. Got it.
Right, and then the incident command system started to come into that because of especially the U.S. Forest Service, because the U.S. Forest Service, compared to the National Park Service, does not have as much policing powers.
Okay.
And that's because national parks have specific legal jurisdictions. Sometimes they're exclusive. An exclusive jurisdiction means that the Park Service has exclusive power to enforce the laws within their national park. Nobody else can come in and do anything. There's also, trying to remember all the different categories. There's also shared, but that's not the word for it, a shared where the deputy sheriffs, and that's what we had at Grand Canyon, deputy sheriffs can come in and investigate crime and on a mutual aid. And then there is another one where they really don't have police power, but they have can only enforce misdemeanor law, and then outside powers have all of the jurisdiction.
Hmm.
Well, it turns out that the Forest Service, I can't think of a single place that has exclusive jurisdiction. So they have all of these mutual aids with Bureau of Land Management, with the local sheriff's department, with local cities that might be near them.
Uh-huh.
And in order for everybody to come to that plane crash and communicate or look for somebody during a SAR, they need to be all on the same page. And so now the National Incident Command System was developed so all of these entities could coordinate and work together.
Okay.
Concurrent jurisdiction, that's what it's called. Exclusive and concurrent, and then there's a third one that may come to me. I haven't had to think about that for a long time.
Yeah, but so I'm imagining that your job as the EMS, the Emergency Medical Services, I think, is that what that stands for?
EMS Coordinator, Emergency Medical Services.
Yeah, so the EMS Coordinator, the Incident Command Framework would have been something you would have been very familiar with, and it would have just been in the background, and you wouldn't have messed with it unless there was some sort of major incident that required it to be kicked in.
That was correct at the time, but later when I worked at the Grand Canyon, almost anything that involved more than one patient, we did an ICS on.
Okay.
And that was because of detailing resources. And part of that was because we had so many resources coming in. We at Grand Canyon, just to divert for a second, we had people who needed to do crowd control, people who needed to control the road, people who needed to do the investigation as to why that fire happened. You'd have the structural fire people come in. You had the EMS people come in. So you had a lot of people, and everybody needed to know the ICS system.
Got it.
And so your incident command, your logistics, your operations, your this, your that, and there are vests to that. And so everybody knows their jobs, and it is a requirement for all protection rangers to take these incident command classes.
Okay.
Several of them.
Got it.
Yeah.
And it's so in Sequoia in 87, I'm assuming you didn't have that type of Grand Canyon framework in place.
No. Uh-uh.
Okay.
No.
Smaller parks, smaller.
There was small structural fire brigade.
Okay.
But they didn't enter buildings. In fact, I don't think they still do. It's all defensive firefighting because they don't have the. They have the training, but they don't have the experience.
Okay.
So if a car catches on fire, they can put it out. There was an incident about, I think it was 20 years ago, where the fire in the search and rescue cache caught fire at Lodgepole.
Oops.
And they just stood outside and started to put it out. It wasn't worth any of their lives to go in for equipment.
Mm, yeah.
And that was like their big fire every 3 years kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Whereas at Grand Canyon, I mean, we went to several fires a week.
Yeah. So, okay, so at Sequoia, you've got two jobs now.
Right.
You're doing
coordinator
and interpretation.
Right.
So
and I did
how did
that
you balance that? Really?
Oh, yeah, I did that. Well, it was the scheduler. You know, this,
okay.
You know, I worked like 4 days of a week for as a naturalist for 3.5. And then those other 2 days were the things I did, the paperwork or scheduled training. I went from different areas. I went to Cedar Grove. I went to Grant Grove. I went to different Mineral King and specifically put on continuing education courses for the people who couldn't come to Lodge Pole, for instance.
Oh, okay.
As well as Ash Mountain. So I traveled from place to place and did that. I think it was 89-90 where that really kicked in. But I started as a paramedic and doing some of these early things in 87. But I don't think the designation, now that I think about it, really happened until the end of 88, 89, and 90. Yeah. It's trying to remember all the details of that period of time.
Yeah.
But I was definitely doing, getting in the helicopter and flying off into the backcountry of Sequoia National Park. And I remember specifically, I just came out of a backpacking trip to an area near Moose Lake. I'm going to take a drink of water. Moose Lake and the area cross country. We would love to hike cross country. And I came back out, and because I had search and rescue training and stuff, they said, we have a Sierra Madre search and rescue team here. We have a missing hiker. You just came from that area. Did you see anything? I said, no. Well, since you're familiar with it, would you fly back in with them? So, yeah, and, you know, here I took several days to hike out, and I'm back in there in 20 minutes. And it was just like, oh, man, this is something, you know. So ever since then, you know, you've always gone, oh, if only a helicopter would come, you know, when you get really tired at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So I was doing those kinds of things at Sequoia National Park.
Okay.
And then in the end of that time, I again went back to Naturalist at Large for a month. And then I worked as a paramedic in Fresno, California, from October to the end of December in Fresno.
That was in 87.
Right. And then something really exciting and very different happened. My older sister Kathleen had married a man who got his PhD in genetics from UC Davis.
Okay.
And he got a job at the University of Northern Iowa teaching genetics. And he called me in November and said they don't have anybody to teach general biology or, you know, the 200 student big classroom thing here, or somebody to teach the anatomy, physiology, pathology for the nursing students in the nursing school.
Oh, wow.
And you could do both of those. And if you could come and do it, they'll pay you to do both of those, give you a place to stay, and you can come be an associate professor here at University of Northern Iowa. And I said, well, what a great adventure. So from January to May of 1988, I went to Cedar Falls, Iowa, and it worked great because I was just in the same town as my sister and her two kids and her husband. I got to visit them for 5 months.
Cool.
I got to teach for the real first time as a university professor.
Cool.
So I taught the big, you know, 200 people in biology class and the more intimate, and did some innovative things for them because this nursing school was still dissecting cats, and I said, well, this is ridiculous.
Ooh.
Because even when I taught at Fresno State as a teaching assistant, we used human cadavers.
Right.
You know, and so I made arrangements to go to, I'm trying to think, University of Iowa, and to go to their cadaver lab with my students.
Cool.
And so they could actually see all of that. So we did all kinds of things, and I set up programs where I got my brother-in-law to do this because he was an athlete, and showed him how VO2 works, the percentage of oxygen used during athletic events. And so I got him to put on, you know, all of the equipment it takes and get on an exercise bike, and they could see the amount of oxygen he was using, the CO2 coming out. So I did a lot of innovation things so they could see physiological changes in real life situations.
Cool.
I think.
Huh.
So I really enjoyed teaching there. And I'm going to put a plug in for a story that was written in, I want to say it's 54 or 55, by a man named Tom Godwin, G-O-D-W-I-N. And it's called The Cold Equations. And I make every single one of my students, ever since then, read that story as an assignment. In fact, my students just now in EMT just read that one. And it's a powerful story. Yes, it's a kind of a science fiction and space story. But what they get a feel for is the consequences of actions and not thinking things through ahead of time. And it's really a clear story to that. And if anybody wants to look up that story and read it, I think it's very powerful.
Cool.
I had all 200 of my biology students read it, and I got some very powerful feedback from all of them.
Oh, wow.
So anyway.
It's interesting because those classes are typically, in quotes, weed them out, end quote, classes. you know, where you know, the kids are, I got to take a biology class, so
right.
Here we go.
Yeah.
But gosh, what a great way to help those kids.
Yeah, and that's true. And one of the things I tell my students right now is I said, I'm not here to trick you. I'm not here to see how many of you I can get rid of. I will tell you exactly what it takes to pass this class and to do well in this class.
Hmm.
You know, and I teach them like tricks, like, for instance, if somebody used a phrase always or never in a science question, nothing is always or never, so forget about that. You know, and how to take a test, don't look at the answers. What pops into your head first? See if that's among the answers, because your unconscious brain knows more than you do. So I do everything I can to enable them and not get rid of them. That's
cool.
Sort of my philosophy.
Yeah.
So anyway, I started there, and in the University of Northern Iowa, we were the Panthers, and I learned how to play broom hockey. I never lived in that cold before. When I would walk from my apartment to teach class, it was sub-zero temperatures. Actually, I was cold before in International Falls, but I never sustained cold. And so when your eyes would tear, it would immediately freeze and little tiny balls of ice would run down your cheeks.
Oh, yeah.
And if you rubbed your eyes, your eyelashes would break off. So you learn different things not to do at UNI. And then, so I did as much exercise as I could when it was cold, but then it started to go warm. Then I'd love to run, and I would run around the cornfields adjacent to the campus, and I would run
like a square mile,
4 miles
kind of thing.
It was 4 miles, so that was like a square mile on
right.
Ice.
It was a mile, so mile down the road, hang a left, mile down the road,
yeah.
Hang a left. Okay.
And I got to watch the corn grow.
Oh gosh.
And I learned about how almost every teenager in Iowa, their job is, as a teenager, one of their first jobs is called detasseling the corn, where they take the male anthers off the corn so they can selectively fertilize it what they want to. So I learned a lot about stuff I didn't know about. And you know what? Iowa is not flat. It's got these rolling up and down hills. Let me tell you, when you run it, it's not flat. So I left there in May, and it was great to have spend time with my older sister and her family. And later on, when she died of myasthenia gravis, I went back to Iowa to be with her kids, and we've had such a close association ever since then. So
wow.
It was really kind of a neat thing.
Hmm.
And then from May to October, I went back to Sequoia National Park.
I can't help but think that Northern Iowa University, they would have offered you, come stay with us.
Oh, you and I? Well, yeah, it was interesting because that was part of the equation. And there was a beautiful Victorian house, I'll never forget it, right on the Cedar River, $28,000.
Wow.
Which for me at the time was affordable. And I thought, okay, but I'm a California girl, and I like going from place to place to place and figuring out the world. I don't want to sit here and do this. This is in a classroom teaching. I want to go back to Sequoia and be a naturalist.
Cool.
So it was a fun gig to do for a while. But it wasn't anything I wanted to do permanently at that time in my life.
Yeah.
So I came back.
And so,
you're right, I did get some nice feedback.
Back at Sequoia, did you again be a naturalist and a dual job of EMS coordinator?
Right here, naturalist. It says naturalist paramedic here.
Okay.
Okay, and then you need to understand about the National Park Service. In order to be a permanent park ranger for the National Park Service, you have to work permanently for the National Park Service or the U.S. government.
Okay.
So as a seasonal at that time, there were very few avenues to permanent jobs. And so if you got your status, as it is called, we used to call it the golden key, that means you could work as a seasonal all year round, none of this 6 months at a time stuff, but you wouldn't get the benefits. but it also meant that you can apply competitively for openings as a permanent employee for the National Park Service. At that time, a seasonal could not apply for a permanent job. There was no pathway for me to go work permanently anywhere as a park ranger. So I had to go get my status. And back then, it was well discussed amongst seasonals. Well, you could always go work at Wall Street or the Statue of Liberty. And the Wall Street and the Statue of Liberty, most people don't realize, are national park areas. So national parks are not just national parks. They're monuments, battlefields, recreation areas, historic sites. All of these are national park areas. Now there's over 430 of them.
Mm.
You know, there's probably 390 at that time. And so people would do that. They would work for a day, and then they would leave because they only had to work a day and get their status.
Oh, wow.
And so that really put a bad taste in people's mouth for the National Park Service.
Yeah.
And they began to catch on, and they blackballed these people.
Huh.
So if they did that, they didn't get hired anywhere.
Got it.
So the goal was to work for a place for a specific amount of time, because only worked one day and you've got your status. For instance,
you mean like 6 months or a year and a half or 2 years?
It depends upon the different things. Now, it's not just the National Park Service. You have to work as a permanent for the government.
Okay.
My friend Marianne Carlton worked for the USGS in Palo Alto, and she worked for them for 3 months.
Okay.
In her winter season. Now she has that all-important Golden Key status. So I thought, well, shoot, you know, I've been doing this for 13, 14 years now. Maybe I should get my status.
Yeah.
I think it was 12 years at the time. So I applied for a paramedic position for the Department of the Army at Fort Ord in California.
Wow.
And I got it. And so I worked as a paramedic for the Department of the Army. You know, you live in Monterey or one of the places over there. And I had a room in a nice place. And I worked there, and I had a very nice supervisor. And
what did you do there?
I was a paramedic. I worked. If they had a call in the fort grounds, we responded as EMTs.
Was there an ambulance?
This is the Army fort. Yeah, there was an ambulance.
Okay.
I was a paramedic. So we had some mutual aid, so we might respond out off the property of the fort, but that was very rare.
Okay.
So somebody cut themselves in a shop somewhere, somebody had a syncopal episode or fainted somewhere. We were the EMTs, and there were a lot of civilian employees, and there were a lot of Army employees, and I was a civilian for the Department of the Army,
Okay. But
I got my status.
Wow.
And I was there for a while, and then Death Valley called and said, I think this is where it happened. This is when it happened. They called and said, hey, somebody just quit. We need somebody over here to work. And I said, well, okay. Let me check and see, because I'd worked for them for long enough.
How long had you worked for them?
A couple of months.
Okay.
A couple of months.
All right.
And there was no obligation for how long. You know, they never said. They just said, here's your job. And I said, and I went to Jose, who was my boss, and I said, I have this job, and this is a protection job. This is 100% protection at Stovepipe Wells at Death Valley National Monument. It was not a national park at the time. And I said, and he said, that sounds like a really good job. I'd like that job. you go and do that job. No problem.
So oh, wow.
All the paperwork, and I checked my books back in the library, went to all these different departments. I had my status.
Wow.
And the status runs out after 3 years. Unless you work for the government, even seasonally, it stops the clock. So if I another way to get your status, by the way, is to join the Peace Corps.
Okay.
So working for the government permanently somewhere allows you. But I didn't screw you. We learned very quickly, like Marianne never wanted to work permanently for USGS. I was never going to work permanently for the Army.
Right.
So if you were going to leave early, they would never hire you back if they felt badly of you. That's fine. Just don't, you know, mess the department you wanted to. So I left, and I worked until April of 89 as a park ranger at Death Valley National Monument. And that was a very interesting situation. I was at Stovepipe Wells. I was a seasonal ranger. And my boss was a really nice guy, and he, within a couple of weeks of my arrival, got an offer to work at, I think it was Wall Street as a permanent, or somewhere in New York.
Hmm.
And he took that job because it was a career, you know, advancement. And so, and then the other, they had not filled the district ranger position yet. So here I was a month into my position, and they specifically hired me at Stovepipe Wells to be a park ranger protection paramedic. And that is because in the wintertime, we have all these snowbirds come. They have major medicals all the time.
Hmm.
I dress them in my books, Park Ranger sequel, quite a few calls at Death Valley. And so.
But you had no boss and no boss's boss.
But here's the best part. I became the boss of at Death Valley, the boss of myself. There was nobody else there. And volunteers. I got some volunteers. I taught them how to drive the ambulance so I could get them to, you know, pick it up. You know, somebody in like the maintenance division or somebody else, somebody who was a park employee who could legally drive the ambulance.
Yeah.
I also got upgraded things. I went to Las Vegas in Clark County and worked with the paramedics there to get equipment. So I was able – I should backtrack a little bit. In order to work as a paramedic in Death Valley, I had to be a certified paramedic for ISMA, which is the Inland County Emergency Medical Services Association. So to do that, before I went to Death Valley, I went to Mammoth in California, which is part of ISMA, and I got checked out as a paramedic there working on the ambulance there. And they said, yeah, you've got all the skills. I passed the test, so now I can do that. So you just can't walk in the door and be a paramedic. You have to jump through all these hoops.
Right.
So now I'm the EMS coordinator for Stovepipe Wells and the Northern Monument, and but there was no equipment. So I immediately assigned myself to Las Vegas, and I went there for a couple days, and I made arrangements to buy some of their old LifePak 5 monitor defibrillators for $1.
Oh, wow.
They could transfer it to other government entities.
Yeah.
As long as something exchanged, you know. They couldn't give it to Joe Blow on the street. So I came back with two heart monitors and left one at Furnace Creek and brought one to Stovepipe Wells and ordered IV bags and ordered a warmer so they could keep the bags in and get them warm. So I started to – then I worked with the my EMS coordinator liaison happened to be out of Las Vegas. Even though it's in a whole different state, the details don't need to go there. So I got a bunch of medications and drugs to utilize from, you know, epinephrine to albuterol, you name it, to take care of asthma, heart attacks, everything.
So and so the people in Las Vegas were your medical control? Is that how that would work?
Yes, kind of. But I was working for the state of California.
Right.
It was, like I said, it got complicated there.
I bet.
So anyway, I got everything I needed to be a paramedic, and then I sat and I looked at the map, and I realized I was the only protection ranger for a million acres.
Oh, boy.
And I loved it. I loved it. It was like, this is mine, all mine. So I'd go up to, you know, Mosaic Canyon, or I'd go up to Towns Pass, and I'd go up and just, you know, do all the things you need to do. But remember, I'm not just the EMS person now. I'm search and rescue. I'm structural fire. I am law enforcement. So I was stopping people, you know, and there's quite a few very, you know, I consider them very engrossing and spectacular calls that happened while I was in Stovepipe Wells. And for instance, when it wasn't that year, but it was the next year when Nancy Hagerman came down to be the EMS coordinator for the entire monument, we had some training one day down at Furnace Creek. And at the end of the training, I was driving back to my area at Stovepipe Wells. And I was driving past Salt Creek. Do you want me to tell a story?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I was driving past Salt Creek, and I was in a marked patrol vehicle, and I had all my equipment in the trunk of my car from search and rescue to emergency medical services and stuff. And I was passed, while I was going the speed limit in a marked patrol car, by a rental car. I said, well, that's kind of ballsy to pass a cop.
Right.
Exceeding the speed limit.
Right.
So we went, I was following them, turned on my lights, as we say, we lit them up. And just as we were turning the corner, just past the cutoff to the Mushroom and Beatty intersection, I saw this big plume of dirt in the sky. But I'm busy going after these people, so I stopped them, and there really wasn't much of a shoulder. So they had to stop in the middle of the road because we're at the Devil's Cornfield, which is all sand. And so I'm behind them, and my vehicle is offset to give me protection when I go talk to them. And it turns out they are just people who want to get to Lone Pine now. They're from Argentina. I spoke Spanish to them, and they gave me their passports. And I'm starting to walk back to a car just as another car comes screaming up behind my patrol car. And I thought, ooh, this is a setup. What's going on? Turns out they said, there's this big accident, you know, up here. So that's what I saw, that big plume of dirt.
Got it.
The accident actually happening.
Mm.
So I went back to these guys, and I told them in Spanish, slow down, obey the speed limit, wear your seatbelt, and got back in my car and went to the intersection. And because I was at training, I had my tie on and my Class A uniform. So I'm, you know, as I'm driving, I'm pulling stuff off, and this is just a big mass casualty incident. So I asked for the world to come. And so people from the Scotty's Castle and Stovepipe Wells and Furnace Creek all responded eventually. And again, it's in my...
I was going to say, they're miles away.
They are. It took 30 minutes for my first backup to come.
Wow.
And I had four patients. One was dead. One was almost dead. One was near dead. And one was injured pretty badly. And again, this is a story called T-Bone in my book, Park Ranger. And without going into a lot of details, it's called Flight for Life. And there's only one helicopter. And, you know, I had one defibrillator monitor, and I was defibrillating one guy in an ambulance and jumping out of one and jumping into the other one with the same monitor and defibrillating the next one. So it was quite the call. Quite the call.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's also the time when a park ranger from Furnace Creek, it's now dusk and we're wrapping up the patients. We're either waiting for the coroner or the patient's gone. Two of the patients went to the hospital. Two of them died on scene. Were called on scene, I should say. And then I hear the fire chief say, "Hey, Irish." And I turned around. It was Kent Meekum.
Oh.
He was a friend. And that was the first time he ever used a nickname he used for me. And because he knew my Irish background. And we had talked as friends. And we had not had dated. We had not anything. We were just whatever. But that was sort of the beginning of our relationship. And then we started dating soon after that.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of backing away here going, wow. I hear stories about being understaffed. This is this is crazy. It's just...
Here's where you need to have judgment. So I have the sand dunes at Stovepipe Wells. And I get a report of, or actually I'm driving. And it gets even worse because I stop at a information post at a place called the Mushroom on the Beatty Road and the Scotty's Castle Road.
Mm-hmm.
Because once I leave that and go down to the sand dunes, I have no radio communication.
Yeah.
So I stopped there, and San Bernardino was our dispatch at the time. So I said, San Bernardino, 4R24, going into the sand dunes. I see a glow in the sand dunes. I should get back to you within 20 minutes. And if they don't get back to me within a certain amount of time, then they call out people to come.
Okay.
What's going on. So I drive into the sand dunes, and I turn off my lights as I make the approach around a curve. And so nobody knows I'm there. And I see this huge, huge bonfire, minimum 11 people there.
Hmm.
Several cars, 11 people. And I watch them for a while, and they're dancing, and they're doing whatever they're going to do and all that kind of stuff. So I backed out, went back to the kiosk and reported back in what it is. And I said, and now I'm available. And, you know, went and did my report. There's no way in the world if I got every park ranger in Death Valley to come respond to this, we still wouldn't have enough.
Right.
So there's a time when you just sort of clean up the bonfire the next day. Nobody's being hurt, killed, murdered, or whatever. But that's illegal what they were doing.
Right. And so I just think about, you know, park resources. Well, there's a couple different things. You have these major accidents, as you had. And if you hadn't been there, you know, there'd be four fatalities instead of two. And so, you know, it's real difficult. I can appreciate a little more the staffing issues.
Right. And keep in mind, this is the late 80s.
Mm.
So this is 30 years ago now. And when I went to Grand Canyon in the 91 and stayed there until 2008, I think it was when we finally left, things changed dramatically for the National Park Service. They realized that was an issue.
Okay.
And so more and more people were becoming park medics, trying to get people to be paramedics. Protection rangers were increasing and getting assigned. So a place like Grand Canyon, which had protection rangers for the Inner Canyon, the South Rim, the North Rim, Desert View, and Mead View, that if you look back and go back to the 1980s, that never happened before.
Hmm.
Even had river rangers who had, but they didn't have protection duties. So now all these people had to go to FLETC, had to have their commissions, and had to know, because it's not just for the area. Maybe nothing happens on the river, but let's say you're on the South Rim on your days off and a mass casualty occurs, or a hostage situation perhaps. Has that ever happened? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all hands on deck, so you need all of these people to come and respond.
Right.
So things did change, and something else began to change. All of these people were under the superintendent of the park. He took care of the ranger naturalists, the protection rangers, fee collectors, maintenance workers,
administration,
all that stuff.
Sure.
And so here you had somebody who might have been in another park promoted from chief of maintenance to the superintendency.
Okay.
And has no clue what a protection ranger does.
Right.
And so cuts the budget, doesn't let them hire people. Things happen.
Mm.
Investigations happen. It's a problem. So there was a real push in the 90s for something called stovepiping. That means that the park rangers who are law enforcement and protection, their boss is the district ranger, and then the district ranger's boss is somebody not in the park, somebody who understands what law enforcement needs. And there were some superintendents who did not want to have that happen. They wanted to have control of everything that went on in their park. And this was the hugest battle of the 90s, I can tell you that.
Huh.
So, but it wasn't made public at all. I don't know if you've even heard of it, Tom.
Uh-uh. Well, stovepiping, yeah. I've heard of, but I never knew what it was about.
Yeah, one straight line from the person in the field to the person who makes the decisions. And if you go through the superintendent and then go to, you know, the law enforcement specialists, and that's when, what's his name? Starts with a B. Help me out, Sarah. Anyway, he became the boss. He was an investigator. He married the, Elaine Leslie.
Oh, so,
Berkowitz,
Paul Berkowitz.
Paul Berkowitz. So he became the stovepipe head.
Okay, so hang on a second. Wait, let's back up a bit. First of all, how do you spell Berkowitz?
Oh, B-E-R-K-O-V, Berkowitz.
W-I-T-Z?
I'd have to look it up, Berkowitz. B-E-R-K-O-W-I-T-Z.
Right, but he's written a couple of books, The Case of the Indian Trader, and
National Park Ranger,
Mafia,
like
the Yosemite Mafia.
What was the one about the investigation at Ganado?
Yeah, The Case of the Indian Trader.
That was an excellent book.
Yeah, so let's back up a bit. So you've got a protection ranger, boots on the ground, patrol car, et cetera. They have a boss, a district ranger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you got a large park, it'll have multiple districts.
Then you have the chief ranger.
Right, but there's a law enforcement specialist. Now, how did it come to pass that somebody said, we need this guy to be overseeing these people?
Okay, and it wasn't so much, Paul Berkowitz came in not necessarily to do that, but to set up switching to stovepiping if that could happen. I don't believe it ever happened.
Okay.
But because you had the chief ranger, and then the chief ranger went to the superintendent.
Right.
So Paul Berkowitz came in. Not all national parks have a law enforcement specialist, which he was, the LES.
Okay.
And what he did is he was now in charge of investigations. as you recall, Grand Canyon was so many calls, and I mean, I alone did 400 calls a year as a protection ranger, include EMS, SAR, structural fire, and law enforcement. Right. Law enforcement, easily over 125 calls. And so we had our own magistrate's court with a circuit judge who came in.
Okay.
So a place like Death Valley, when I arrested a drunk driver, I drove them out of Death Valley, took them to Lone Pine, California under a mutual aid agreement, put them in the county jail.
Okay.
Then I then I went back and presented my case as the seasonal ranger of why he was drunk driving. I talked about, you know, his field sobriety tests that he didn't do well, and, you know, the probable cause and all of my paperwork and all that kind of stuff in front of the judge, the federal judge that was there.
In Lone Pine?
Lone Pine.
And so that's how many hours away for you to drive?
Oh, 6 hours round trip.
So I would assume, given how busy you were, that for some people that might be, I'm not saying this for you, but I would think other people in that position would say, I'm just not going to arrest the guy because I'm going to lose a day just driving.
And that's what I had somebody who was shooting across lanes, throwing rocks in the air, shooting, that should have gone to jail, and I wrote him a ticket instead, mandatory appearance.
Hmm.
So you're exactly right. But a place like Grand Canyon, on the other hand, who easily has 50 times the calls of Death Valley,
right,
easily, had their own magistrate's court, had a magistrate judge,
had their own little jail, but even
little,
even the,
well, we called it a holding facility. It couldn't legally be called a jail,
yeah,
because didn't spend the night with it.
But even
and
the Coconino County Jail in Flagstaff was only an hour and a half away. It wasn't 6 hours away. I mean, they're like driving
that's
to
right.
Tucson from Flagstaff with a prisoner.
Right.
This is not going to happen.
Yeah, well, it wasn't 6 hours away. 6 hours round trip.
Oh, round trip. Okay. So it's driving to Phoenix and back from Flagstaff.
So here, now you've got these sophisticated calls. People are coming back with lawyers now to the Grand Canyon who are ready to beat their drunk driving arrest.
Ah.
And they're ready to do all of this and that. So for me to become the prosecutor was not going to happen at Grand Canyon. For little cases, that's fine. I would testify as the arresting officer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when we start to have court officers. And what was Craig's wife's name? Craig, not Lutz. Anyway, so we began to have court officers who actually presented the case. And Paul Berkowitz was brought in not only to be in charge of the court officers, but also because now we had 9/11. And now we had people who were evil people. Now we had so much going on in the United States that anybody who had a federal law enforcement commission was desperately needed to take care of terrorism.
Hmm.
And that was the worst part of my job when I transitioned into post 9/11. We were required to go on homeland security assignments.
Okay, hang on
and
a second. Wait. We need to back up because we're still in 1989.
We can come back.
Because there's a cute guy that said, "Hey, Irish," and I'm like, "Wait a minute, I don't want to miss that."
Okay,
But let's go back for a second. Hang on a second. So I just want to clear up with stovepiping for a minute.
Yeah.
Through the 90s, because the concept was, I've got a ranger on duty, reports to a district ranger, and instead of the district ranger reporting to
they report to the chief ranger.
But instead of them doing that, they would report to an LE specialist.
No, they report to the chief ranger, who then reports to the superintendent. What they wanted to do was bypass the superintendent.
Oh.
And go to a regional law enforcement specialist, which is what Paul Berkowitz was.
I see.
Yeah, so no, they'd still go to the chief ranger, Paul Steve Bone at the time when I first got there, I think it was. And then and then Steve, instead of going to whoever was the
Weinberger, whoever
superintendent
the,
or the
yeah.
superintendent, would then go to the regional specialist and of course keep the superintendent informed, but decisions would not be made at that level.
I see.
And they
right, so that is a
stacking, they began stacking the deck after 9/11 to enable stovepiping, but I'm not sure it haven't been out of it. I don't know if it ever really happened.
Because I can see where a superintendent would say, well, wait a minute. I want, you know, you're keeping me in the loop, but you're basically answering to a regional LE specialist. So now we're starting to have a whole nother framework of regional, and there must be a DC as well.
And that's where things start to get carried away between being a protection ranger and being a cop, a police officer.
Hmm.
So now when you make them exclusively law enforcement with these other duties, then that's what a handful of people want to be. They don't want to be structural firefighters. They don't want to be EMS. They resent having to have to go on these other calls. They just want to be police.
Wow.
And that's where you have problems. And then you have people who are night shift rangers in the summertime, and we'll talk about this more, who 90% of their calls are law enforcement, and they act like cops, begins to give everybody else's protection ranger a bad reputation. Superintendent doesn't want that, wants to curb their powers, you know, and so then you're going, but we have to enforce the law. No, you don't have to. You can be nice and give them warnings, and they don't understand that we're dealing with somebody who just pulled a knife. And
right.
So, or somebody, or a nice person who was trying to walk home without driving their car. The problem was is they were lost, and so they were walking down the middle of the road following the yellow line in the middle of the road.
Right.
So, you know, and so we had UIA, under the influence of alcohol, in the park area. So the magistrates did a good job of reining people in. So UIA, it's not against the law to be intoxicated in the national park, but it is against the law to be intoxicated and being a danger to yourself, a danger to the others, or causing property damage.
Right.
So you have to have these two things going on.
Yeah.
So if somebody were drunk, we could give them rides home.
Right.
You know, but some of these night shift people would wait outside the bar before it burned down, the pub, and wait for people to get in their car to drive, and then we'd get them for drunk driving.
Right.
Rather than going up and go, I think you're too drunk to go home in your car. Let me give you a ride.
Exactly.
So that's where a lot of the now we have huge problems with the community.
Was
huge
there
problems with protection?
Nancy, was there pressure from superiors on these rangers so that they would make arrests and have these arrests of drunk drivers to their credit?
Yes, there was later on. There was a supervisor, my direct supervisor by the name of David Brennan, who I knew him as a friend at one time, and then when he became my supervisor, was not the person I knew.
Okay, well, hang on a second. Wait. Because now we're at Grand Canyon. So let's back up.
Right, but let me just answer that question quickly. We used to, when people were driving, we pulled them over for whatever reason. They had a suspended license. We would write them a ticket. He wanted us to arrest every single one of those and transport them to Flagstaff for our arrest statistics. And we didn't want to do that.
Got it. So somebody was looking somewhere at you know, wanting to show doing a good job in some report somewhere. And so that would come back as pressure on the staff.
There were people like that changed how we did things.
Okay.
And other things like that we can get into when we get to the Grand Canyon, which is the whole reason we started all of this, isn't it?
So let's back up. It is. We're getting there.
All right. So
don't want to rush. let's go. I'm curious. You had this mass casualty event, and there was a guy named Kent there, and you had met Kent at Death Valley. Did he?
I'd known him for 8 years.
Right. Had he stayed at Death Valley all that time?
He had. He was a permanent sub-district ranger at Furnace Creek and the structural fire chief. And actually, we became friends. We really didn't start dating till 1989.
Okay.
But we became friends, and he called me that, and it was really a nice thing. And, we were all seeing other people at the time, you know, when we met years before, and also we were just friends for all these years, and I think that kind of helped our relationship to have a basis in friendship.
Yeah. So I'm going to back up even further.
Okay.
Here you are in your journey with the Park Service, and you're working as a seasonal, and you're 6 months on and 6 months off, and you're going from different places. Yeah, Sequoia is your home base, but you're going out to these other parks. Meanwhile, here's someone like Kent who is a structural fire chief. And I, Yeah, I mean, I would.
But no, he was a protection ranger.
Okay.
He was a that was part of his collateral duties because there were so few structures and so few fires in Death Valley. There was no need for a full time position.
Okay.
So it was a collateral duty.
So was he permanent?
Was he what?
Was he permanent at the time? Back in 89?
Yeah, he was permanent.
Okay.
In fact, he was always a permanent. When he came out of the Marine Corps, he went into being a dispatcher, and then he worked at Yellowstone, and then he worked at Lehman Caves, which is now Great Basin, and then he worked at Death Valley. So he'd never been a seasonal.
Okay. And he'd been in Death Valley for, as you mentioned, 8 or 9 years by 89?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because I am thinking about sort of the 4 year kind of golden window of, all right, I've been at this park for 4 years. It's time to go someplace else.
I don't know where that comes from.
Okay. I'm just thinking about sort of the climbing the ladder journey.
If that's what you want to do.
Yes.
I suppose if that's what you want to do. My goal was never to sit behind a desk if I could help it.
Right.
I never wanted to be a superintendent, a chief ranger, anything like that.
Mm.
Yes, it was a lot more money and it was more responsibility.
Right.
But that's the problem is you have middle managers in the National Park Service who have no business being middle managers because they have no people skills.
Right.
And they have, they just want to move themselves up.
Mm.
And I've always, when I was a supervisor, it was my philosophy, if you take care of the people, then the operation is fine. If you screw them to try to make the operation work, then it doesn't work. So a lot of my supervisors in the past have screwed you to try to make the operation work, and that's another story for another time.
Yeah,
but, So, yeah, it's this golden thing. A lot of people find a park, and they're just happy as a clam, and they don't feel the need to leave. I had a friend of mine who was at Sequoia National Park for 32 years.
Hmm, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Loved it. Why go somewhere else?
Exactly. And so, but other people in the park service look and say, oh, that person's not enhancing their career. They're not, you know, not good for the agency, if you will, in quotes, because they're at the same park. And yet I think of people like John Riffey, who, you know, just refused to leave Total Weep his entire career. He found a place he just loved, and he fought like heck to stay there.
Right. If you go to places like Tuzigoot or Mesa Verde or Chiricahua or some of these littler places like mm-hmm. that, some people think that they've gone to the black hole of Calcutta.
Hmm.
There's nothing going on there. There's other people who go, this is the place I want to be. I'm in nature.
I've died and gone to heaven. Yeah.
I mean, who was it? His name just went right out of my wife died of breast cancer. He moved to Prescott. Anyway, he was at the Grand Canyon forever as a naturalist.
Stu Fritz.
Stu Fritz. You know, how long was he there?
He and Donna, I mean, she was on the trail crew before they met. I mean, she was on the first female trail crew.
That was their heart park.
Yeah, that's right.
If I could get to, Sequoia and be a permanent there, I would have. But when you get married, it all changes what you do with the park.
Well, back to 89. You weren't going to spend too long in Death Valley, were you?
No. In fact, I left in April.
You did leave in April in Death Valley. Okay.
And I also was doing things for the Sequoia Natural History Association. I'm not giving all the details, but I used to do backcountry hikes. I would take people at the end of my season at Sequoia or in the middle of the season, they'd have me take days off because the Natural History Association wanted my skills, so I would use my days off to teach a backpacking trip on glaciers and granite.
Or
I did one where I went all the way in, I think it was 86, John Palmer, who was the chief naturalist, who was also at the time in charge of the Natural History Association, said, I need you to guide this trip from Giant Forest to Mount Whitney, and we'll give you extra days off to do it for the Natural History Association. I said, well, okay. So I did that.
Cool.
And
wow.
So for a short time, right after that, before I went to right after that in January, I did cross-country skiing and natural history instructor for the Sequoia Natural History Association. And then from January to February, I was again the park medic instructor in Fresno.
Right.
For the National Park Service. And
March and April in Death Valley.
Yeah.
And then when you and Kim.
No, no, no. Not that year. Let's see. Let me think what I did. What did I do in March and April, 89? Yes, I was. I was back in Death Valley.
Right. So when you and Kent got together, were you at Sequoia? Was that that summer of 89?
No, no. What happened is I went back. Well, I went in 88. I went back to Sequoia.
Right.
And I worked as the park ranger naturalist, paramedic, EMS coordinator.
Right.
And then from October to April, that was a 6-month stint at Death Valley.
Okay.
This was kind of hard. Is that correct? Did I have that down? Let me get my dates right. 90. And then, yeah. So, 89 to 90. And it wasn't till the end.
So you'd be in Sequoia for the summer of 89, and that makes
right.
sense. But right. And that's going to be until October.
Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of meshing things up a little bit, but the bottom line was when Kent and I started dating at the end of 88, I think it was, and I may have this right, when I went back to Death Valley, I was all set to go back to Stovepipe Wells. He would be the acting district ranger at Furnace Creek, and I would be at Stovepipe Wells. Dale Antonich, A-N-T-O-N-I-C-H, told me, no, I was working at Furnace Creek. And I said, well, I don't want to work at Furnace Creek because I'm dating Kent Meekum, and he would be my boss. He says, I don't care if he's your boss. And I said, well, yes, I do care if he's my boss for dating. And he said, if you want this job, this is where you're going to be. And so
I was
down at Furnace Creek living with my boss, Kent Meekum. And there was another seasonal ranger by the name of David Yim, Y-I-M, and I sat down with him and I said, I don't want to work here. We are co-workers underneath Kent Meekum together, and I'm living with him, and there's going to be a perception of favoritism and all this kind of stuff. And so I sat down with David, and I said, if it ever comes across that way, I said, I really don't want to do this. He goes, and he was the coolest guy. He was so neat. And he goes, you know, those things happen in life. He says, whatever. You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that's so, very true. But it's still,
but
gosh, it's tough.
It is. And then Kent's immediate boss between the chief ranger was another man named Mark Messia, who was not a good boss, who was not a nice guy, who took advantage of the situation, unfortunately. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I don't need to get into personal stuff. But I was persecuted by this man because of the situation that I did not want to be in, making me do stuff and other stuff like that. So when I went back and I worked at Furnace Creek, and you know, in November when we have the 49ers, there's a huge campground called Sunset Campground, and you have 2,000 RVs there.
Wow.
And you have Texas Springs, and then you have, you know, the fiddling contest, and that's the fiddling contest that I talk about in my book called Carnegie Hall, where back in the previous year in 88, I'd had a man at the Liars Contest stop breathing and his heart stopped during the Liars Contest. And I was up on this little stage trying to make sure he got back, and I had to do CPR on him, and they brought the ambulance down and did everything, and unfortunately lost him. During the Fiddler's Contest, I'm over at the Visitor Center, which is probably 300 yards away, and I just had taken a woman who'd had a heart problem off to the airstrip. When I got back, they said somebody's collapsed on stage. So I ran from the visitor center, didn't drive my car, ran from the visitor center, it was much easier, through the palm trees all the way over to, it wasn't even that far actually, I think it was closer than that, didn't have to go all the way through the palm trees. And there's, you know, 400 people in the audience, and I'm jumping up on stage and running a code of this apneic compulsive person, and I thought, well, shoot, I can't call him dead on stage. All these other people are going to have heart attacks. So we put him in the ambulance and drove as if we were going to the airstrip when, in fact, he had actually died. So, but that's a story called Carnegie Hall. So, my calls just, and that it was a good thing that Dale wanted me there, because there were lots and lots and lots of calls that needed a paramedic and
right.
needed my skills.
So Dale was willing to cover for you while Mark was willing to make your and Kent's life difficult.
Yes, but Dale Antonich was the chief ranger.
Okay.
So, but the chief ranger was not so much a desk person in Death Valley. We had Dale, Mark, Kent, myself, and David Yim for, 15,000 people a day.
Wow, yeah.
And, there was a call one time. I'm driving through Artist Drive. I don't know if you have been to Death Valley. Artist Drive, beautiful drive. And these people flag me down, this person who's ledged out up on this cliff. So I walk up to him, and I get to a point where I'm like 50 feet below him, and I can't go any further. And I'm talking to them, and they're scared to death. And, yes, if they fall, they would probably hurt themselves quite severely. And so it needs a technical rescue. So I call just Kent. And so the only other search and rescue specialist available is the chief ranger. So Kent and Dale come out, and they've got their equipment, and I'm about to help them. And then we get a call for a motorcycle versus a van collision down past Badwater. And Dale said, go. So I go down there to meet the Shoshone Ranger, two of us working a four-car accident with five people.
Okay.
So that just tells you about what we don't have and do have and who everybody has to do their thing.
Yeah, it's so terrifying. I mean, I think about personnel burnout.
But, back then when I was younger, I loved it. I loved not knowing what the next call was going to be. And part of it was my skill level, my comfort with my skill level, my comfort with my ability to remember how to do stuff. And so if it was a structural fire, and this happened at Grand Canyon, I loved the volume. I loved the variety. When I was a park ranger in protection, I was in the right place.
Mm. Yeah, I guess I was thinking, Nancy, about Dale and Kent and Mark and David. I mean, you're a team of five for what can be terrifying. So you might have I was at a time in my life where I loved it. I'm hoping that the other four were as well. Because if they weren't, if any one of them wasn't, it's like, wow, how do I get out of here?
Well, that's the other thing is people who weren't like that, let me put it this way. The nearest grocery store was 5 hours round trip at Las Vegas.
Right.
Or Lost Wages.
Lost Wages.
College,
yeah.
And didn't like to be without any backup, did not last.
Right.
And so all five of us were people who were of that mindset. We knew that there was nobody else going to be there.
Right.
I think there was another guy who worked for the court, Terry Harris. And, there were people up at Still Pipe Well. So when we went on a call, people would come down from Scotty's Castle and other places to cover our area.
Mm-hmm.
But it was call waiting a lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway.
All right. Well, that gets us.
1989.
We've made it into 1989. This is good.
Boy, this is going to take the next 3 years, isn't it?
Well, it might, because we start in 87, and eventually we'll be going a little faster and it'll be all right. But yeah. We got through 2 years in an hour. That's all right. Yeah.
So I guess the next thing we should do.
You know what? We'll wrap this up. I just want to make sure. Is there anything else you want to add to this interview before we start our next one?
Yes, I just want to clarify that all the stuff I just described happened from October of 89 to April of 1990.
Okay.
That's when I was at Furnace Creek. I was at Stovepipe Well from 88 to 89. And I was at Furnace Creek from 89 to 90.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Cool. That's helpful to just get that time frame figured out. Well, with that, let's conclude part five, Grand Canyon Oral History, with Nancy Milady Meekum. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom.